Hello and welcome to Dicing with Design, episode 5. We've reached the lofty half up to double figure heights.
Yeah.
Episode 5, awesome. This is Dicing with Design with Colin, Grant and Joe. And I just want to, we're going to put out a little appeal this time around. If you can give us some feedback, we'd love to know if anybody's actually listening to this show. So if you can get us on Twitter, you can get us on Twitter at gamercolin.com. No, it's not dot anything, is it? At Gamer Colin. We've got at Grant Sensei, and yeah. We've got at Joe J Prince. And also, actually, we've hit the prestigious heights of having our own domain now, haven't we, guys? So, you can get us at Colin at dicingwithdesign.com, Grant at dicingwithdesign.com, and Joe at dicingwithdesign.com. And if you want to go to the show notes or anything like that as well, you can just go to dicingwithdesign.com and that'll direct you to our podcasting site. So, over to the actual entertaining things. How are you getting on, guys?
Not bad, not bad.
Got some games in since we're last on.
Yeah, good stuff. I think I have as well, actually. It's good. I've been listening to a few gaming podcasts, actually. I've got a few questions for you guys and things I heard about that I have absolutely no idea about, so maybe get to that later.
Alright, cool.
Okay.
So, first things first, what have you been up to this week? Do you want to go first, Grant?
Sure enough, yep. First of all, I took a trip home a couple of weeks ago, and my Kickstarter for Sedition Wars was sitting there. A massive box of minis. And all the extra goodies I got, well, some of the extra goodies that I got through the Kickstarter. And the models look really nice. And they all seem quite...
Sorry to say, what is Sedition Wars?
Yep, as we're discussing it on, actually tell people what we're talking about. Sedition Wars is the... Sedition Wars is the creation of Mike McVeigh, of Studio McVeigh, who's a big name in the industry.
Super famous painter and sculptor, isn't he, of minis?
Yep, for Games Workshop. He also helped to start up Privateer Press when they made their War Machine and Hordes games. And he's also been used as a consultant with Mantic as well recently on their Dreadball release, which is their sports game. Yeah, his main business nowadays is. Making sort of collector's edition minis, really nice resin sculpts, but now he's expanding his science fiction setting into a board game. I think he's going to push that out into making a full size war game eventually, but starting off with a sort of Space Hulk style combat game, which I've bought and it looks pretty nifty. And can't wait to get it out and have a game with you guys.
Nice. So, what's the sort of quick summary of the rules? What approach is it?
Zombies versus space marines.
Can't say space marine.
Oh yes, that's all been going on.
Hashtag space marine.
It's space. Combat people. Yeah.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. The rules are all based on. There's some not entirely unlike Space Hulk.
Okay.
But much more advanced than that. So it's not quite simple. Having not played it, can't speak to it too much.
Okay, no worries,
but I'm quite excited to try the the really cool mechanics are the Strain, who are like the zombies, and they're all based on these nanobots that float around in the air, infect dead bodies, and then more if you add more and more of these clouds of nanobots, can actually upgrade these zombies into harder and harder killing machines.
All right.
The Strain don't have fixed models. They take over bodies and make themselves harder as the game goes along.
Okay.
But the Space Marine types are more of an organized force, and they have order tokens and things where they can focus their attention, so they have a little bit more of an order based system to them, and they're almost like using command points.
Yeah, so there's a contrast between
the two sides.
Sorry, Grant, I was just going to say, it sounds like it's going to be interesting to see how it contrasts with Project Pandora, the Mantic sci-fi skirmish game.
Yeah, skirmish I would say, yeah, from the sounds of it, and having played Dwarf King's Hold, the other Mantic game, I think Pandora is probably more like space, more like Space Hulk, in that it's quite simple. Sedition Wars is more like a miniature board game. A couple of the mechanics, the way that the cover works, does remind me a lot of the XCOM computer game that I've been playing. Which could be a good thing, because I really like that.
Well, if it sounded like XCOM, I'm in.
Yep. Not like get XCOM off of the early 90s.
No, that's it's got to be like that, XCOM. That's the only XCOM.
Sure.
And not Terror from the Deep, either.
That would be the sequel to the old XCOM game, and basically just the same game.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They actually just swapped the sprites. We'll turn these greys into squids. That'll do. It's a new game.
That's exactly what they did, the old XCOM game. Anyway, at the school games club, I got we finished off our internal contenders campaign.
You finished a campaign?
Yeah, Return Campaign Contenders, yeah. The first one ever to be completed, I believe. Certainly,
I think it probably is, yeah.
That's got to be a credit in the book, Joe.
Yeah.
It's a bit late now, the book's in the printers.
Second edition.
Certainly in this version of the rules, one kid got to realise his greatest hope, of course. Have we explained Eternal Contenders before?
I think we've kind of touched on it in what we've been playing, but we've not done a full in-depth analysis and explanation.
Yeah, you may want to save that for a release.
Are we going to talk about that later on anyway?
It'll come up a bit, but not really if we're looking at...
I reckon we should do a full contenders review in a future episode. We'll come back to that.
I think so. It'll tie well into when we're looking at GM-less games as well.
Yeah. We'll put a link in the show notes to the Eternal Contenders website in case anybody wants to go and look at it just now, but we'll come back to it in future episodes and talk about it in depth.
Yeah. Okay, so in the end, I played this character to make up the numbers, which was losing and losing almost deliberately all the time and building up its pain stat. Unfortunately, some poor kid had to face off against that, because even though pain makes you lose at the end of the game, it makes you awesome at combat, because you're feeling so much angst for one turn at least. And yeah, I mullered this poor kid. Sorry. and he ended up losing in this role-playing game, because you can lose in this game. In a way, sometimes it's better to... sometimes it's a more interesting story that you're telling when you're losing. Certainly, I've found that before.
Crushed his hopes and dreams, didn't you, Grant?
Yeah.
What age was this kid, Grant?
13.
Oh, well, he can handle it by that point, surely.
For life lessons.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Grow character and all that.
Yeah. Continuing the ongoing contenders and campaign on a Tuesday night with my grown-up group. That's going well. I'm continuing. If you want to know about that, there I've just posted another post. I'm doing a turn-by-turn account of that on RPGNet.
Mm-hmm. And it's good as well. Really enjoying it. Actually, you're writing it really well, Grant. It's just quite it's quite entertaining.
Yeah, it's cool. This is a steampunk setting as well, isn't it? Which is something that's not seen done before. Yeah. That's pretty interesting. Yeah.
In the end, most of the stuff we're doing is there's as much photovoltaic cells as there is steam power. Is the way certainly my character is going on. So it's almost like electropunk, if you will. Electropunk Victoriana.
We'll link over to that.
I'm inventing a genre by basically ripping off steampunk. and just changing it slightly.
But that's kind of like Ace Date. That's supposed to be electro Victoriana steampunk. It's not steam, it's electricity and stuff. Or Gaslight Fantasy, that's another one that I've heard used.
Really?
It's like Look, steampunk, but we don't want to call it steampunk.
Is the whole is the Frankenstein legend, is that electropunk? If because he's bringing it to life with a lightning bolt and all that.
Yeah.
So actually, yeah, sorry, that just came up because I've just been listening to the Nearly Enough Dice guys again. They always talk about that. You know, the setting that's created around Frankenstein, the legends of Frankenstein. Well, I think it is.
Yeah, the Legacy of Frankenstein.
Legacy of Frankenstein. Yeah. That's the one. Yeah. And that sounds like a really cool setting.
Steve up here in Aberdeen, who actually, I believe, if I remember correctly, wrote the system for that.
All right, okay.
Steve Ironside, yeah.
Hmm, cool.
So I know a bit about that. I've never got a game in. Whenever there has been a game of it up here in Aberdeen, of course, there's been a... Everyone seems to get in before me, so I've never managed to play a game. Maybe I'll get them to play a game next, next time when we change games for the next session.
Yeah.
Anyway... from there, so that's like I said, that if you want to know about that, that's going great guns in the RPG net. We're coming to the end of that. We might actually get there in terms of reaching the limit in the game when somebody reaches 10 renown, and then that triggers end game. We might have to just draw the line somewhere and have the final battles and see whether ultimate fears or ultimate hopes for our characters come to pass, but we'll see how that goes. Next up, we a little bit of Game of Thrones living card game with the kids at school. I've been doing lots of painting from Warriors of Chaos and reading my new Warriors of Chaos pamphlet.
It's a heavy pamphlet.
It's a heavy pamphlet because it's got two big bits of cardboard on the side of it. It's 90 pages, a £30 book.
Yeah.
Welcome to our new feature, Grant's Rant.
So,
and my whole idea for a Warriors of Chaos army in Warhammer Fantasy Battle being a large number of marauders, which was a pretty bad idea in the last book, is even worse.
In the last book, unless they were like Khorne with great weapons, then it was just overly cheesy. But
yeah. No, mm-hmm. I'm determined to do a Slaanesh army because it's taken me 2 years to work out the paint scheme.
They do look awesome, your marauders as well. That's like, yeah, we'll have to find a way to run them. But it is a bit annoying. You invested into painting how many, and then suddenly they're not quite as good as they used to be.
Pretty much the same as they always were. It's just they cost more points, literally twice as much, probably, if I kept them out. If anyone has any ideas on how to run these in a Warhammer Fantasy Battle game, then I'd appreciate a wee line, or someone can link me to a.
Tactica for Warriors of Chaos.
Yeah.
I think like your minimum strength units idea with a war shrine might be the best way to go. Try and get some free demon princes. And just, if there's a niche and you got like a unit of 10 with flails, then you know they're going to make combat because they're not going to run off. They're not going to be panicked. So you can kind of use them as like flankers or redirectors, suicide troops. You know they're going to die, but they'll hit hard once.
Wings of them. Anyway, also, I think that's about it. Oh, no, I've been reading Hamlet's Hit Points. Yeah, I've been doing loads. Hit Points, which is a book by Robin D. Laws, in which he analyses three stories. It's Hamlet, Dr. No, and Casablanca in terms of if they were a game, and in terms of upbeat and downbeat section.
Right?
He's disappeared, isn't he? Okay.
Where's he gone?
Grant seems to have been overwhelmed by the writing of Robin D. Laws, and he's disappeared. I want to know more about Hamlet's Hit Points, because that was always struck me as interesting, but I've not actually got around to buying it or reading it. I've backed the Robin Laws Kickstarter that he had recently.
Right, okay.
Hill Folk, which looks
pretty. Ah, yeah, I saw something about that one actually. There was quite a lot of hype around that, wasn't there?
Yeah, part of the Hill Folk Kickstarter, you could get Hamlet's hit points as one of the
pledges. One of the add-ons.
So what were you saying about Hamlet's hit points, Grant?
I would blame Google Hangouts, but that was actually me hitting the big red X at the top of the top. <Well done. laughs> Why did he put it there? Yeah, absolutely. It's Robin D. Laws. Yes, it's an analysis of the ups and downs and how you might put that in a game. There's not so much... I've not gotten to the end of it, so I haven't really gotten to any sort of conclusion about why this is good, why it's good to have that certain rhythm. He talks about rhythms and every little bit of a scene as a beat, where it's an upbeat or a downbeat. It's a procedural up or a procedural down or a emotional up or an emotional down, depending on the story. It's just, I'm quite interested in that. I've become more interested over the years of what makes a good story anyway, and what we're doing with playing games. So what I like about playing games and role-playing games is it's a way of telling a story. And maybe a more in-depth review once I've gotten to the end of that and actually watched Dr. No and gone to the end of Casablanca, because I was watching that at the weekend because I got a lot of film. And I think that might be just about me. Other geeky stuff I've been doing. I was watching The Wrestler, and I'm reading a book called World War by Harry Turtledove, which is about the Second World War.
Oh, is that the lizard attack?
Yes, if the lizards had attacked, the alien lizards had attacked in 1941.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, they are really good. That series really annoys me now though, because it's quite long. Like, there's tons of books in it, but I can't remember what I got to in it. I've read about three or four or five books, and I can't remember which one I got to. So now I'm not sure where to start again. I'm not going back to start because it's too damn long. All right, Joe, what about yourself? What have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
Gaming-wise, I've not done so much. Apart from the gaming weekend that we had, where we played a few games, didn't we, over in Dunfermline?
Yep. Have we talked about that?
I should have said about that. So
something.
Yeah, exactly. On you go.
So we went and met up for a gaming weekend, and I thought it'd be quite fun to do like a Magic the Gathering booster draft style tournament thing. So I bought a load of cards cheaply off eBay and put them in envelopes, and we all had our little sealed decks, didn't we, and did a little booster draft. Built some decks to play with over the weekend.
Do you want to explain the concept of a booster draft? Because that's something I kind of heard of. I think you told me about it 15 years ago or something, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I probably won't get the terminology quite right for the official Wizards of the Coast booster draft that they do, but basically you go to play Magic. Normally you'll pay like your entry fee of like, what it'll be these days, 20 quid or something, and for that you get so many boosters. I think it's normally about six. And then the idea is everyone sits in a circle, everyone opens one booster, they pick one card that they want, and then pass the other 14 cards to the person next to them, usually to the left, but then it reverses for each alternate booster, and you just kind of grab a card, pass it on, and try and draft the best deck you can from that. So it's quite interesting because everyone starts on a level playing field. You can't just spend 300 quid to buy the best cards and build like the Uber deck that's been on the internet.
Yeah.
And you can't prepare that much because you've got to, it depends what's going around as you decide what colours you want to draft. Like, if you just grabbed every best card, you'd end up with a five colour deck or something, and you'd not be able to play anything. So that's quite entertaining.
It was good fun. I really enjoyed it. It was the first few rounds where you were trying to figure out exactly what you should start collecting that were quite interesting. So you saw a card you really liked, and that pretty much started your colour, didn't it? And then I ended up seeing a theme. There was one special rule. I think it was the... Poisoned?
Infect, wasn't it?
Infect rule. And so I started collecting anything that had that on it. And then it turned out that every bloody card in the boosters has infect on it. But, hey.
I was the only one without Infect. Yeah,
no, Infect was my main strategy as well for winning. I think that's what I won most of my games through, from that flying, infecting white shrike thing.
Yeah. Wow. But yeah, it was really good. Cool. So that was anything else, Joe?
We played old school Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay as well, didn't we? We had a game of that.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting. In a way, it's kind of like everything that annoys me about old school games rolled into one. So I just had to make my own fun by just playing a really odd, obnoxious dwarf. and just immerse in the character. And the way that it's so unbalanced as well, I happened to roll like practically the best character you could get. Like, he was practically unkillable.
Yeah.
It was so hard. It was ludicrous. Like, people did him for 9 damage, and I'd go like, yeah, I'll take one of my 8 wounds.
Okay. Yeah.
Because he rolled maximum toughness and maximum wounds, and then got a toughness increase, and then started with armor and shield.
Yeah. Stone skip dwarf.
Yeah. Which, just the way the system works, is makes it a bit crazy, especially when you've got other player characters running around with toughness 2.
Yeah. I think I ended up with a guy that was pretty good at fighting, but basically I couldn't get hit, otherwise he'd just crumple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
actually, probably good to talk about that later, because that's about the GM and stuff, but yeah, I'm not sure what I thought about the session either.
Yeah, it was a bit all over the place, but yeah, but we'll focus on that later.
Yes, indeed.
And other than that, I'm not really got much gaming. We had a half a game of Battlestar Galactica, didn't we?
Yep.
An abortive attempt.
An abortive attempt before someone mysteriously disappeared and never returned.
Yeah, apparently a very, very tired person who been up since 6 the night before, or the day before. Yeah. Possibly, but hey, I don't know.
Yeah, half an hour later.
Don't know who you're talking about.
Half an hour later, I don't think Colin's coming back.
No, we've been waiting half an hour to do this skill check. I'm in the game.
Yeah, sorry guys.
No worries, I think we're pretty much dead.
Right. Yeah. And the only other thing we've done is started rolling up some old school warbands for Warhammer.
Oh yeah.
The Chaos Books, The Lost and the Damned, and The Slaves to Darkness.
Yeah.
So I had a quick session rolling up some of that. That's just crazy madness as well. So I've just started hacking up a Blood Bowl dwarf to try and convert him into the freak that I rolled up with tentacles and a beaked goat face and extra knee joints and all these other things.
You could probably still extra knee joints.
Yeah.
That's on the table.
I can't even remember who got the poisonous sweat. Somebody got like corrosive sweat or something like that.
That was Russ's guy, wasn't he? Had
right, let's explain that for the listeners, because not that many might remember all the way back to the Realms of Chaos books.
Yeah, to be honest, I have no idea. I got explained by Joe and Russ at the time, so yeah, find a way, Joe.
Yeah, these are the books from the late 80s, I think it was, a kind of legendary first Chaos source books that came out for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and Fantasy Battle, as it was back then. And then if you got the original ones, they go on eBay for a small fortune these days. I've seen them going for like 50 quid and stuff.
Really?
And it is just a book of loads of crazy tables and madness.
Yeah, I've never seen 1,000 before.
Yeah, 3,000 table. You roll your chaos attributes. And I just remember, like, years ago when I bought one of the white dwarfs, probably one that had some of Mike McVeigh's painting in it, but they had, like, an article on Chaos Warbands, as someone had just rolled up their Chaos Warband, and they had, like, this winged minotaur, and then some Chaos Dwarves and a little familiar following around their Beastman spellcaster or whatever it was.
Yeah, and they're supposed to fight off against you. You get your randomly generated warband off of these crazy tables, and you're supposed to make them fight off against each other.
Yeah, but there's absolutely no balance at all.
No, they didn't try to make any balance. They kind of just had this sort of Darwinian system where if you rolled up a crap warband, it would die.
Yeah,
that's just what would happen. You just have to accept that. There's lots of stuff in those books. I mean, just looking at them, this is what's been whittled down into a 90-page book, Warrior of Chaos books nowadays. There was a huge amount of just fluff and all these amazing rules and tables of all these many, many mutations that's all been kind of whittled down and streamlined down into what now is the Warriors of Chaos book. I suppose the Demon book as well. Mainly the Warrior of Chaos book.
And Beastmen, I suppose, as well. But the big
Beastmen have been taken out of the Chaos Wastes and they're now in the forests of the Old World.
Yeah, but they used to be, that's what I'm saying. That yeah. They got split out from the rest of Chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Beastmen. I hate Beastmen, that's why I didn't like my warband, because it was all Beastmen. I'm re-rolling it.
Beastmen in a cold one, he had a beast, like some kind of ghost.
Yeah, that was first, that first warband I rolled up, it wasn't a warband, it was three guys, and one of them was a cold one.
that's a velociraptor.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't quite right. Mine just was completely unbalanced in that my hero was half as good as the brigand chieftain, wasn't he? And yeah. a little helper guy who basically would have kicked my ass.
Yeah. He's a 20th right. level hero, wasn't he? 20th level hero brigand. And your guy was like a 10th level dark elf. Were you a dark elf? Or? No, you
came. No, I had a team of dark elves helping me. I was was I an elf? I can't remember now.
I think you were a horse-faced human, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. That definitely makes me human. Yeah, no, it wasn't the best in the world. But hey, we'll give it a go either way. I'd fancy trying them out.
I don't think it'll take long.
No. 20 minutes.
Five models.
It's cool. More of like a modelling project, I think, really. Because then we have to decide what set of rules we're going to use to run it, because trying to go back to second edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle is going to be quite hard.
Let's not do that.
Yeah.
Cool. Alright, well, next I suppose my gaming, that's it pretty much. You guys have talked about it already the last weekend. I do fancy having another finishing a game of Battlestar Galactica, I have to admit. I haven't played one in a wee while. I was listening to D6 Generation the other day though, and they were talking about it was their go-to games episode, and they were talking about all their genres, and it's given me a list of games that I want to try and look up and maybe try and get hold of on eBay. I can't afford to buy them all new because there was too many of them, but just talking about Battlestar, they were talking about Shadows of Camelot. I think, is that the Days of Wonder game?
Yeah, that was out before Battlestar.
Yeah, and it's kind of the other classic co-op, but with a secret traitor, basically, game. And I quite fancy that.
It's quite as advanced. I don't think I have this whole find out halfway through mechanic.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I've no idea what the rules are, obviously. But
and there's no, the rules don't change once you've revealed yourself. Right. So it's not quite so sophisticated, but apparently.
Well, they were giving that a good review, so I thought it was worth a try.
Mm-hmm. They gave Wrath of Shardlon a good review as well.
I do not like it. Oh, aye, well, who was it? Joe, you were talking about that, weren't you?
Yeah, because you were saying you wanted to give it a try.
Yeah.
And I've got it, and I've played it. In fact, we touched on it on the Advanced Hero Quest episode last time.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That it's, I think, was it Grant who summed it up quite well? It's playing a game, it's like the front of every Terry Pratchett book. That's what the game's like. You know, where just everything's happening, everything's going on, everything happens in the
game. Yes, I remember talking about it now,
Just like that,
What about, have you guys played Rune Wars?
No.
No?
No.
Because they were chatting about that sounded quite interesting. It's kind of a dungeon crawl board game. So I suppose it's maybe a bit like Wrath of Shardlon, actually, but they were saying it was really good, so yeah. Anyway, there was a few names that I picked up that I'm going to try and get hold of. Maybe more stuff to talk about in the show, obviously.
Cool.
So apart from that, that'll do us, I think, for what we've done this week. So shall we move on, probably about half an hour into the show, move on to the main topic. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the role of the GM this week. The role of the GM in designing and running a game.
Hi folks, it's Grant here. I was just wanting to add a little bit in here, I realized while editing, that we were referring quite a lot to this document that I'd made up in the afternoon before the show, where I talked about 7 and then added another one as one in as the conversation went on, 8 points about just what exactly the roles of the GM are. So I thought I'd go through those one by one, just very quickly here so we know what we're talking about. Number one, I put in scenario designer. It's almost self-explanatory. We're talking about placing challenges, monsters, traps, corridors, also any help, NPCs into a setting for the scenario for that day. Now the point there is that they're trying to make a fair challenge to the players, as well as making it an immersive experience for the day. Okay. Secondly, as the monster player, the evil wizard, as it's called in HeroQuest, the overlord, as it's called in Descent, having put the challenges in place, it's now the GM's job during play to act out what an orc would do, what an evil mercenary would do, what that band of bandits would do to the characters, which is nothing good in most cases. Thirdly, the rules designer. Okay, if there's something he wants to do, if there isn't a table for it, he's got to design a rule. A good example of this was when Matt in our Game of Advance HeroQuest came up with an entire rule set for dealing with stealth in out in the open, which there's nothing for Advanced HeroQuest. We came up with that blip system that was close to how things are done in Space Hulk, which worked great. Also, of course, when you're designing rules, there just isn't an eventuality for in the rule set. Number four is the referee. Okay, if rules queries come up from players, if there's something in the rules, again, that two rules that during the game contradict each other, he's got to decide, no, you can't do that to a player, or realize that there's something he has to make up on the spot. The director, we're getting into narrative territory now, he decides where the action will go, okay? He decides where scenes will start or finish when we've had enough in the scene. He can refuse requests for scenes to happen if a player wants to start a scene. He wants to go and role play out a scene between him and a contact trying to he'll give him vital information. He can say, nope, you're not getting that scene. I don't feel that's kind of in the tone of this setting, or it doesn't feel that it fits into the pace that's being set by this game. Next one is I put in a dual role of real life leader / skivvy. Not always the case, but often the GM will be the guy who's a leader in terms of at the table, and will take that role on to real life, where he's the one getting everything organized. Usually he's the guy keeping all the records. He'll be keeping some sort of log of what the players do and don't know. And also in terms of real life, where he's the guy who's going to have to provide the physical setting for the game, okay, around his house, but not always. 7, keeper of secrets. What's going on behind his screen? One thing the GM is allowed to do, but none of the players are allowed to do, is keep secrets from the GM. Or keep secrets from everyone. Okay? If a note is passed between two players, the GM's got to see that. Okay? If a note's passed between a player and a GM, which I know a lot of people hate, but it's common practice. I think done right is fine. None of the other players see that secret note. The GM's got to see it. He has to know what's going on. Lastly, world builder. It's taken a step above the scenario designer. This is creating the setting where the scenario is going to happen. Okay, right, let's get on with the show.
Yeah. So this was Joe's topic, so I'll let you introduce it, Joe. What were you thinking along these lines?
Well, it kind of links into an article I did not so long ago for Geek Native, or I was going to use the era of the GM over, and then the follow-up article about building a GMless game. I call it design without a safety net. because that's what I think the GM role basically is. It's a safety net kind of for the designer. Like if a mechanic doesn't quite work, the GM can ignore it or house rule it. Or if the pace slips, the GM has to pick up the slack. Yeah.
Well, there are just those many rules that the GM has. I've written down 7 things that he does. And did you get that thing I sent through earlier on?
Yeah, it was really good. That's the grant, yeah.
Ooh, right. No, I haven't got that, I don't think.
All right, I shared it on Google. Yeah, I should have just emailed it like an email con because I couldn't share it. But it's on Google Docs. I thought I shared it with you.
You sent it by email as well, Grant.
No, just to you, though. I thought I was using the sophisticated modern version of by sharing it to Joe, but that didn't actually
work. Don't use technology, Grant. It never works. Never works.
I should have just put it in the post box last week.
I should be able to get... Oh, I've got it here. It's all right.
Yeah, that's kind of it's a funny way to think of it, though, Joe. So you think basically that designers should create a game that runs perfectly every time based on the fact that there's no one there to save it if it's going wrong. It just requires much more precise rules, much more solid mechanics. Is that what you're thinking?
Ultimately, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I think. I think a GM's kind of like a patch. Like if you imagine that someone did an online game or a video game that in order for it to work, you need someone running it, running the monsters, deciding what happens, putting the encounters into place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or a war game, which is what used to happen. You have, I think I said before, I don't know if it was on one of our pilot episodes, sorry, I'm speaking to my hand. I don't know if it was in one of our pilot episodes where we're talking about Warhammer. I've got a borrowed Matt's copy of Warhammer 2nd Edition, and it's got... It fully expects you to use a GM.
Yeah, and that's what definitely came up with looking at the warbands, the Chaos Warbands. Like the whole idea of that is that there'll be a GM running the game who'll come up with scenarios to try and help balance it out slightly or so that it doesn't matter if your warband's a lot weaker than another one, there's still something for you to do in that conflict, in that encounter.
So back in those days, there wasn't a need to balance the game, or to even have a tight set of rules that actually fit together. And that's kind of, so what you're saying, Joe, is that's kind of persisted with role-playing games, whereas in other areas, that's tightened up and we don't need a GM.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you look at Warhammer, that's a good example from back in the second edition days, because it was so loosely defined, you would need a GM to be the balance, so that two people getting together to have a battle could have, you know, both have a reasonable chance. Whereas now, in 8th edition Warhammer, you know, you get flame wars and threads about which units are overcosted and which are undercosted, but you don't play with a GM, it's just two players turn up and play each other with their books, and it pretty much works. Yeah, you're always going to moan about Hydras being too cheap, or Night Runners being pointless. But
yeah. Well, I still think
it's never worked against you.
Yeah, I always think it's amazing how balanced Warhammer Fantasy is, given how many different rules and how many different units there are.
Yeah, and I think they have got better in the recent editions. In 8th edition, seems the 8th edition books so far seem a lot better than the 7th edition books when it comes to balance.
Yeah,
but that's all moving further away from the idea of having a GM to straighten it all out.
Yeah.
So you're saying that role playing games are kind of being left behind in that advancement in the industry, and in sort of the art form of games design.
Do you think, are you thinking basically, you say left behind, but I mean, we play a lot of the old ones, like our main sort of proper RPG is Rolemaster, and surely that hasn't, the books that Matt's using these days haven't changed. When did he buy it? Are they like 1980s books or something?
Yeah, at least 80s, yeah.
Yeah, so like...
Yeah, but we're not just playing Rolemaster, we're playing... Matt's Rolemaster.
Yeah, yeah. But if you take, I'm just sort of thinking, if you take that though, and say D&D, how much are they actually changing? How much have they changed in the last 10 years?
I mean, D&D's changed a lot through the editions. Yeah, I mean, Rolemasters kind of is defunct now. It's not. I don't even know if anyone owns the license to it.
Or
probably you can get the old PDFs. They're probably out, but it's not had anything new for a long time. And the latest edition that came out, I think people just preferred the old stuff. I remember Matt picked up some of the latest edition of Rolemaster when they were still doing new editions, which was, I don't know, probably...
It's 97?
Yeah, something like that. I think it was when they were at uni, so... Yeah, it probably was about 97. And then I think they tried to do a light one after that, but people didn't really like it. But it's just, I think the role of the gems kind of become like a sacred cow in role-playing games. It was for a long time. It's kind of like, well, there's always been a gem, so we need to have a gem. Mm. So the vast majority of games that were written from that traditional mindset was that you look at D&D as a template, and that has a games master. So you have a games master who runs the world, and then you have players who play their characters, and that's it.
I think from looking at Rolemaster and looking at the amount of books and the amount of tables in there, looking at D&D, my experience of it, and this of the reason I like those systems is because of the kind of concrete rules in there, the amount of detail that's in there that tells you exactly what happens. Like, you fall off something 5 foot tall, this is how much it hurts, this is how many hit points you lose, that kind of thing. That looks to me like they've designed in quite a lot of detail, though, and there's not that much in the way of crutches. Like, GMs are actually constrained quite a lot by the level of detail in these books.
Well, I think when it gets to that point, there's so much detail that the GM just ignores it.
Right,
and just makes it up as they go along. Do you think Matt has ever looked at a folding table?
No, but I mean, you were saying at the start that you think it's making them lazy, basically. You think it's making games designers lazy because they've got a GM to take over. But maybe I'm just looking at the big games here which have been developed over years and have had a whole lot of work put into them. Which games do you have some examples of games you think are a bit lazy because of the GM being present?
It's not so much they're being lazy, it's just that they're kind of blinkered into, like, it's got to be like that. And then, yeah, they'll have 100 of different tables to talk about different scenarios that might come up. You know, you've got your falling damage, you're falling and drowning, how long you can go for food in the wilderness.
Yeah.
But that level of complexity, I don't think in a story game you never really need. And if it will come down to GM, the GM will just make a judgment on it. Very rarely they'll actually look it up, and that's kind of when the games start falling apart, when they start looking up things on that level of complexity and like going, I've got to consult this table now.
I suppose is that designers using GMs for the wrong thing? Because that's stuff that tables, well, I don't know. Is that the stuff that would be fine for a GM to do just to make up, this is what happens? Because you can guess, you get hit by a sword, there's 10 hit points, that's half of your hit points gone, so you lose an arm, say. But it's actually the stuff that you would want a GM to do are the more sort of story-driven elements, the more plot-driven stuff, the more the things that affect how much players enjoy the game, as opposed to this sort of really mechanical, you die this much, or you whatever.
Well, I think that the GM has to do it all, and that's why it's such a difficult role to have, and it's a lot of responsibility, a lot of pressure, and that the GM is, because you're telling a story, but the GM is the author, the GM is like, has the final edit. Everything has to, in a traditional, this is like, I'm talking like the traditional sense of role-playing games, everything has to go through the GM for it to be okay. And it takes a lot of control and creativity away from the player, I think, when they always have to ask, like sometimes it's called like a mother may I approach, where you have to ask, you know, can I do this?
Yeah.
May I do this? Is it all right for me to do this? Is there a is there a fork on the table? No, there isn't a fork. All right, well, I can't to eat the sausage with them.
That sounds like the best session ever. What's the challenge rating of that sausage?
I tackle the sausage. I eat it. Devoured.
That's it. But it can get to that almost that level of ridiculousness. Whereas I think if the mechanics themselves just gave everyone more authority to narrate things into the world, then you don't need that they're all the GM. Because the moment the traditional way the GM has it all, the GM has access to rule zero, basically, that they can overrule anything in the game at any point if they feel like it.
Yeah, yeah. But then again, how do you draw the line, though? How do you put the limits in while still allowing the players to have that that control? Because obviously, if you have no limits, then there's no fun, basically, because you can do anything you want.
Yeah, you need, it's good to have constraints, but I think it's good to have them encode like into mechanics. Like if you look at internal contenders, that's a good example of when it's your turn, you pick a type of scene from a fixed choice. You've only got so many choices you can make. Or you can have something free play where you can role play anything, but none of your stats are going to change. So if you want something meaningful mechanically, you have to pick from one of the other types of scenes.
Yeah.
But you know within that scope how far it can go.
Yeah. I think what you're saying there is even though you can have limitless potential in terms of where the story goes, success or failure is actually very, very strictly controlled. If you fail to say in Eternal Contenders, if you don't spend enough money and you don't make your the check for connecting with your connection, then you don't gain hope, and you know it's a failure. You can narrate whatever you want, but as long as you narrate that you failed it, you've failed in that scene because you've not played the mechanics quite right, or that you got unlucky. You know, you can describe that any way you want, and then you'll build things, introduce characters, and build things into the world, and introduce an entirely new part of the setting is part of your failure. But you've failed, and you're going to have to narrate that.
Yeah,
yeah, it makes sense. I have to admit, yeah, I was. That last Rolemaster game that we played, when Matt asked us to basically create our own scenes and write in something new for our characters,
yeah,
and then I actually did write something, and I know it was a little bit outrageous. Well, I didn't even think it was that silly. I mean, he could have decided what he wanted that monastery to be or whatever. Basically, I for everybody listening. In that campaign, I play a plasma mage who doesn't really know anything about plasma. He can cast it like crazy, but he doesn't know the science behind it. So he's just a wild mage who's just sort of figuring it out as he goes along. So basically, my mission at the moment in that campaign is to try and get a tutor, or you know, find out something technical about this magic so that I can use it so much better. So Matt had said that we could. Write whatever we want, we could create our own scenes. So I wrote in that I discovered along the way my whole mission for the last we were travelling north, weren't we? So we had basically
we were travelling north, and it was going to start from the battle, but Matt said, yeah, you can call for a flashback scene. We
get
one flashback scene of something that happened on the journey north,
yeah,
which was for a traditional game, that's kind of the GM giving the players a lot of creative input.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's way beyond the bounds of the usual school game. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it worked really well, didn't it? Because the flashbacks were great fun, yeah. And we pretty much did everybody's. But basically, I wrote in that along that way, those 2 months or whatever it was, I'd been looking the whole way for like somebody with even a hint of magic about them, so I could find somebody that would lead me to a tutor. And then I found something, and basically the scene ended with me discovering a monastery or a old building which was full of magic users. But that was vetoed.
Because that was the rest of our flashbacks all built on something that was established already in the world and the story, and you just invented this whole thing.
Yeah,
which didn't really fit in with the world, especially because it's a really strictly controlled magic.
Well, the thing is, it fits in with Colin's, what Colin's view of the world is, because otherwise he would ruin it.
Moment. Yeah, totally. So I don't, and I realize it was a wee bit sort of, I wasn't sure whether Matt would let it go or not, but I wonder.
You were telling me before that you didn't know whether he'd allow it or not. Yeah, you did know. Your
but I thought maybe I would get like a lower version of it or something like that, or you know, downgrade it slightly. So I hadn't found a monastery, but it was like an old scroll or you know anything.
Well, yeah. On the other hand, I think your scene ended up pushing towards that. Because the scene that you got did push you a little further towards your long lost brother, who would know about this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But then you didn't, as I remember the last time we talked about it, you didn't actually remember that scene because you were too drunk.
Yeah, that's the disadvantages of port on a role playing night. But no, I'm not complaining here because I realised that it was a bit of an outrageous thing to write, but yeah.
But it's an interesting example of the GM's role and the GM stepping at that and just flat out saying, no, that doesn't happen. Yeah. That monastery doesn't exist.
You're talking on the director.
Yeah. I think I suppose my point there was that Matt gave us that creativity, and he's probably listening to this because I think he does sometimes and shouting at the speakers, but he gave us that creativity. He gave us that option, but then didn't actually let us follow through with it in some ways. So, but well,
you took it a bit far. You gave us an option to call for a scene that could have happened on the way, but I think you took that creativity too far to create like a whole new load of powerful magic characters in a world where that's very rare, where it wasn't established, where there was nothing in the fiction that hinted at that being there.
Well, that's kind of the point I'm getting at. How do you allow that creativity but put bounds on it? Because there were no bounds on that. I realised that was a bit outrageous, but that wasn't. We weren't told that. We weren't set those limits, really.
No, and you're right. That's part of the GM's role, kind of controlling the narrative, controlling what goes in and what goes out. So if it had been like a GMless game where everyone had free rein to call for their scenes and define their scenes, then yeah, fine. Yeah, you find that magic monastery. They train you up or whatever, and that would be your choice as your scene, unless you've got a mechanic where people can veto things or say, you know, spend a story point saying, well, I'm going to spend a story point because I don't think that should exist in the world.
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword, though. I mean, it is an advantage, I think, if you have one person and their vision kind of driving the whole tone, then I think it's a little bit less. I don't know. I think with loads of people, there's a danger that the whole vision can become kind of, what's the word, disparate, where everybody's got their own ideas, and if they're quite diverging, everybody's ideas are quite diverging. Then it doesn't kind of, the plot doesn't hang together quite as well as it would when there's one person, one director, the GM in charge. But then you end up the flip side of that is you do feel disengaged from it if you feel your ideas aren't fully being put across in a GM game.
It's a good point. I think that is maybe one of the strengths to recommend a GM led game. That's when I say if the main purpose of the game is to explore the world and find the answers to questions.
Yes, that's one. That's one rule.
One person controlling that probably. It's very hard to do that if everyone's got free reign to make.
Yeah.
But that's only one type of game, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, in Matt's defence, that's what makes his game so great: the fact that he has that world in his head, and every time we walk around a corner, there's something new and deep and great. So. It's worth having those bounds on his world, because it is his world, because the stuff that we can discover is great, and this kind of the what we can do in that world is so much fun as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to use the GM's role. If the game, if you're designing a game that you really want it to be about exploration of a world as if it was real, like simulationism or whatever you want to call it. Or if you want to do it like for a mystery game, like a whodunit style. Solve the crime, then it's probably better to have one mind, one vision of what the world's really like, and then everyone else is finding their way through that.
And have that exploration aspect.
They can give you the revelations then gradually as you find stuff out, as the players find things out, and it'll hold meaning and hang together because it's only one person. Because it's very hard to do that, like you say, if there's lots of people with all their own views on how the world should be or what things might get revealed, then it can become quite disparate. Having said that, like the game Inspectors is like a investigation-based game, but it is where everyone has narrative input. I think that's sometimes... I mean, I haven't played it a couple of times, but I did find that sometimes it does get a bit kind of... It doesn't quite hang together, and you get to a point where it doesn't really make as much sense as if it was just a straight-up investigation that someone's written the scenario beforehand.
So does that work like a game where... you don't know who's done it because it hasn't actually been decided yet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, you don't know who the bad guy is or who's... It's like a Ghostbusters style game, but you get plot revelations, I think, if you roll a 5 or a 6 or something on your skill check, which is done with D6.
I feel like interrupting. That's quite a cool premise for a game where you would kind of maybe players could try to paint the plot into a corner so that the other person wouldn't know how to do it. So instead of so that you could some investigators are working the players' investigators have to almost kind of work out how to stump everyone else into even coming up with an explanation as to how their favoured suspect could have done it.
that's an interesting idea. So you're getting at the so you need like a pool of suspects and then people to establish certain facts
in the plot. You're almost planting planting the evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you take your turn and you spend your resource just to say, that person couldn't have been Professor Plum. He was with me last night. And then the person who's trying to put Mr. Plum in the dock has to figure out a way of changing that. Oh, sorry, I'm going off on a massive tangent. Hey, live game design, we're good at this.
Live game design, yeah. That's how I games. And I think Graham Walmsley's A Taste for Murder is a bit like that. Although I don't know you don't actually try and paint other people as suspects, but you don't know who's done it until halfway through the game, and then one person becomes the detective and has to try and... they'd figure it out, or do they just decide who did it? I can't remember. Anyway,
I'll put a link to the show. Link to that in the show notes after editing or during editing.
So check that out. Another stuff, and probably more of formulaic stuff as well. We should touch on for the role of the GM, just in terms of like deciding when scenes start and when scenes end. That usually falls to the GM, but it can be done through mechanics.
Like if you in a GMless game.
Yeah,
thing is, I find it easy to get mixed up between a narrative game and a GM-less game.
Yeah,
because I don't know if they're both the same. I mean, because I played Over the Edge, which is, you know, a very stats light game. It's a huge, proper, big book, and there must be a tiny amount of rules and a huge amount on the setting, because it's definitely a narrative game, and there's loads of opportunity for putting like little sort of character shticks and manipulating those traits aren't just numbers, how much is strength, how much is constitution, how much is dexterity. It's I've got a pack of cards in my pocket, and that tells me that I'm a gambler. And whenever a scene comes up where I can say I'm using my gambling, then I get bonus dice on the roll, and things like that. You know, I've got a hat that hides my head, and that shows you that I'm a mysterious bounty hunter.
No, no.
Okay. Mysterious milliner. Yeah, it shows that I'm a bounty hunter, and actually that made him a time traveler as well. It was a really good game that. But there was a GM. There was a GM in charge of that, and he would decide whether your justification for, you know, he had a plot in his head. He decided the scenes that would. Or at least the starts of the scenes, and he would be the arbiter, the referee. It's one of the roles of the GM. He'd be the referee over whether you would get that bonus. I'm echoing again.
You are echoing a bit. Oh, and it's by Robin D. Laws of Hamlet.
That is Robin D. Laws again, actually.
And Jonathan Tweet, who did Over the Edge. Yeah.
I wrote down one of the things that you wrote down, Grant, in your wee document here. About the GM's role as the enemy, basically.
Yeah,
I always think that's quite an interesting one. Like, has the monster player or the evil wizard?
Yeah, the reason I put evil wizard is that's the role that he plays in the classic hero quest. Descent 2. I didn't talk at all in the last episode about Descent 2 or Descent. Pardon me, it's in its second edition now. It's Fancy Flight's Dungeon Bash game.
That was another one, D6 generation we're talking about, actually.
Yeah, they play that a lot. Anyway, the time is gone for that. But, you know, the Overlord or the Evil Wizard are the monster player, and the scenario is set up. And in those games we talked about, the scenario is already set up for you, which is why it's quite a strong role. Or the alien player in Space Crusade. They had a scenario set up, so the pressure isn't on them to make the game... balanced for the players. They can kind of take on an equal role in everything. The quote GM type player is just the bad guy and can go balls out to kill everyone without excuses.
Yeah.
Or thinking, oh, they're not gonna like me because I haven't designed this scenario right.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because you've got to make it fun, you've got to make it challenging, but you've got to not piss people off. Like, how do you... Yeah, because you're not your friend, but you're not their enemy.
The first two things I put on that list are scenario designer and monster player, and they're totally at odds with each other, or can be at odds with each other. And what it winds up being is to not lose your friends, and or at least you lose your players, When you're being that monster player and taking on the role of the monsters and the traps and the big bad guy at the end, you end up having to fudge it. You end up having to change your design.
Sometimes, but that's where design can help you, mechanics can help you. Like, if you have some sort of resource limitation for the monster player, then that makes it fair. That makes it people know they're on the same page. You can't just have another six Dark Elves coming through the back door because the players look like they were going to win that fight or something. But in traditional RPGs, there isn't that balance. There isn't finite resources that the GM can always add or take away. But that's something that some games have addressed and done quite well, I think. 316 is one that comes to mind, where there's the alien player. That's where you are playing like colonial marine starship trooper type characters. But every planet you land on has
not space marines,
no, Greg Redshaw, not to mention space marine in the book.
Damn it, you're gonna get a
although it does mention power claws, but I know it's power glove, something like that. Anyway, there's a certain number of alien threat tokens that the aim player has, which represent the amount of threat on the planet. And once they're all gone, the planet's done. The Marines have killed all sentient life on that planet, and they can move on. safe in the knowledge of a job well done.
Of extermination.
Yeah. but that is fair, then. You know that the GM's not just screwing you, because it's upfront with how much he's got to throw at you.
Yeah, yeah. I saw an interesting comment actually. It was in Google Plus. A guy had asked a question, and he'd just run a game where he'd done something. He was asking everyone else what they thought of it, and what he'd done was, they'd set up the game as a pretty standard high fantasy thing, so they'd rolled up elves, dwarves, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then they'd played through sort of the first half hour, and then suddenly they'd been taken in by some kind of warp and ended up in today's world. So they were elves and dwarves and all that running about in the middle of London, say, in the 1990s. And he was asking people what they thought about that kind of change in situation, and a lot of people were feeding back saying that they would just hate it. They were like, they'd invested in a game that was going to be fantasy, they invested in a game where they can use the skills of their dwarf and their elf and all that kind of stuff. Like, is that kind of thing all right from a GM? That's obviously taking a whole lot of control, but I think that sounds quite cool. I would quite like that game.
It's a big wrench, isn't it? And like you say, if people have invested in it being a certain type of game, and then it's suddenly something totally different.
Yeah,
you're suddenly turning it into an urban fantasy, which is no bad thing in itself. But a lot of people don't like fantasy in that style.
Yeah,
they want it in a fantasy world.
It sounds a bit like a gimmick. It's like, why are you doing that? Is that going to create a better story, or is that to just so you can fight people with guns?
You know? Well, I suppose that's the scenario design thing, isn't it? I mean, that's designing in a problem that has to be solved. So you're in your fantasy setting, something happens to your characters, whereby they become beset by baddies, and they've got, you know, they have adversity they have to try and get over. But it's just, the thing that seemed to get people about that was that, yeah, they wanted a certain type of game, I guess. So I suppose even, is it bad even if a GM, I don't know, creates like a fantasy horror type of thing when people thought they were just going to get standard fantasy dragons and things? I mean, is that kind of scenario?
Depends on the players.
In modern day, completely rips the entire story out of fantasy and makes it something entirely different.
I quite like it. It's like reverse Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if the point then becomes they've got to find their way home,
yeah,
then fair enough. Well, that could be quite entertaining. But
yeah,
the point is like, now you're elves and dwarves in
I saw it as they had to solve the problem, they had to get home. Yeah, it was like they were taken in by this warp and they had to try and reverse it or whatever.
Find a solution. Imagine this. If Matt were suddenly to do that to our characters in our game we've been playing for 12 years, would you be happy about it?
I honestly don't think I'd mind. I think it'd be quite cool. Just something different.
I could take it if it was only as it wasn't part of canon. If we just said, right, let's throw this.
It's an alternative universe episode.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of comic book standard practice, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not sure. No, sorry, I just thought I'd throw that in because I just remembered I'd read that just a while ago, and I thought the whole comic thread, the comment thread around it was quite good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an interesting point, and I think it's like James got to know his players and know what they
know them better
out of the game themselves at that point.
Yeah. It's whether the GM has to cater to the players, basically, what the players want, or whether it's the GM's game. Like, whose game is it?
Yeah, and that's another struggle with the role of the GM as well, but it kind of becomes their game because it is more important. They'll usually be doing the scheduling as well, and they've got to do a lot more work, a lot more preparation. Yep.
I've got 8 rules, actually, because I forgot about world building, which is different from scenario designer.
Oh, yeah.
Skivvy.
real life leader/skivvy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I find with our long term campaign that it's usually us driving the next game. It's usually us that's pushing to get another session done as opposed to GM.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, our game's very different from most games though, in that we play so infrequently. I think that's because what keeps the quality of it so high is what I think.
Yeah.
Matt always has so long to prepare.
I don't think that matters. He always does it on Friday night at the weekend.
Even the night before.
Well, maybe it's more recharging than preparing. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's right. I can imagine that games become pretty stale if you play them pretty much every single week. Even though I think that'd be amazing because I've never managed to actually do that.
Yeah, it is hard to keep that going, keep that momentum going of something, you know, bringing something every week, and it just tend to get samey, or you run out of ideas. And that's the other thing that Jim can feel under pressure to run a game when they're not really up for it or not really ready to. But they know that if I don't do this, I'm letting everyone down. There's no game, so I'll just try something. I'll just buy a scenario off the internet and run that, and probably won't really work. Doesn't really make much sense for us, the characters, but they'll bash a few orcs, so it's fine. But if I think about the Gemma's games again, like if those tasks are divvied up between the players, like everyone gets to contribute and bring ideas in, introduce characters, introduce plots, then it just makes the weight a lot lighter. It's all shared, so it's not all on one person.
Yeah.
To bring all that,
I do find sometimes it's for a GM-less game, you do have to be if you're not in the mood. You know, if you're not hugely up for it, you can sit there, roll some dice, and say, oh, "I'm killing some orcs," and that's fine. Making something up sometimes it can be difficult. But having said that,
I think to me there's definitely a place for both. There's definitely, like, I really enjoy a GM-led game where there is that, like you were saying earlier, Joe. There's the whodunit, the puzzle solving, all that kind of stuff. It's hard to have that without a GM. And I definitely enjoy that, probably more often than the GM-less stuff. But then again, I love playing a game of L&L, for example, Labyrinths and Lycanthropes, where we're just basically collaboratively coming up with the world. But that's more sort of a quick and dirty fun game, I suppose, isn't it?
L&L's interesting case I could do to talk about, because that's one where, although... I don't know. It's GM-less, but it's not, because you just take it in turns. Like, one person will be the labyrinth lord for each labyrinth. But it's got a lot of things that we talked about. You've got finite resources in terms of the monsters you can throw at the party, and the bad guy player is trying to win, is trying to get a total party knockout and lock them up in prison, so that their character can then come and rescue everyone and look great and level up.
Yeah.
But then it rotates, so someone else gets a go at being the bad guys.
Yeah, so it takes away a lot of the disadvantages to being a GM, i.e. alienating your friends by killing all of their favourite characters.
Yeah. And you don't have to take a turn. There's not one person responsible for prep, because everyone builds the world together and everyone comes up with ideas for the labyrinths and stuff, and ideas for the monsters.
Yeah, and half the time when we play a game of Labyrinths and Lycanthropes, that's the most fun part, is when we're coming up with a map and all the stupid names for all the places and stuff like that.
I might revisit that and do a second edition at some point.
Just
a version that's more kind of pick up and play, so everything's done already, so you've got like more monsters that you could just use and a map that's already there, so you could just jump straight into it. Although it is fun coming up with your own.
It probably would be good for a really quick game to have that, but definitely keep in the rules that you can, or definitely keep in a section.
Maybe more of an expansion than a whole new set.
Yeah,
quick start expansion type thing. Although I did read online that one guy who really liked Labyrinths and Lycanthropes and been running it online. Can't pronounce his name, Philip. I think his Polish name, Lukudzik. I can't pronounce his name. But
racist.
He'd been running it for Conan, but running it straight, playing it straight, just using the mechanics for a straight up fantasy game, and it sounds like it works really well for that.
That sort of sword and sorcery, Conan type.
That's cool. Has he got a write-up of the game anywhere?
There's probably one somewhere. I don't know where to find it. Maybe on Story Games or somewhere like that.
That's cool. I might have to ask about that afterwards.
Yeah, I think he was running it on Vassal as well. He had like a thing
set up so you could see what cards everyone was dealt. Although I've found that it works just as well, if not better, if you use D20s instead of cards, for at least for attack rolls and defense rolls, because then you get less ties. If you've got a computer set up to do that, it's dead quick.
But yeah, sorry, I suppose to go on just a little bit more about what I was saying before, the time and place for each type, is there's also definitely a time for the really creative narrative driven games as well. There's sometimes you're just not feeling very creative and you need a world set out in front of you. And other times you can have a great game by totally making up the story and making up the narrative, and actually it works really well. But that is definitely one where the player's mood and energy levels and all that kind of stuff come into it.
Yeah, having said that, I mean, I had all the kids I've had coming into the school, and especially on my Tuesday night games, I think it's 4 or 5 sessions we played. We've not had a down session. In fact, I've gone in sleepy and come out kind of up, because we've actually got a really good group, I suppose, at the games club. We've all sort of taken it on and kind of bounced off each other with ideas for the world a bit. And so I've always been in the mood, whereas I think I think the collaborative process that has actually pushed me up. I think it's a lot of time we play Joe's games is or we play try and play a GM-less game, it's we're trying it as a one-off, and then just starting it can be quite tough. But once you get over that first bit, you started to create the world, it kind of generates its own energy.
That's true, yeah. I'm thinking of a lot of the times when we played Contenders or similar, where we never end up actually finishing, so a lot of the time spent is actually creating the characters.
Tough kind of startup phase. But if you got something you're already been working on, evidences from playing it at the club that it's worked really well.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose that's why we end up going back to the same characters in those type of games sometimes. It's like, I'm bringing back that one from the last time.
Easy. The story's not quite done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
To finish that off. And that's a good point. It's one with the collaborative games. I think part of what you were saying, Grant, is even when you come in feeling a bit tired, like energy levels low, you get you buy into it, and you don't have the option of just turtling. Like if it was a GM-led game, you could just think, oh, I can't really be arsed. I'm just going to sit here and flick through the equipment list, and I'll roll some dice. If we get in combat, I don't really have to do anything else. I won't bother. Whereas if it gets around to, like, it's your turn, right? What are you doing on your scene? Do you want to go shopping? Do you want to try and mug this guy? Do you want to start? Do you want to have a duel? Do you want to go training? And then you like have to input a bit more, which wakes you up a bit.
Your list of possible scenes does give you inspiration. It's like, what do I want to do? Or even just looking at what you get from the resources that you gain from each scene, whether you want to get more money or to become better at fighting, or if you want to get yourself closer to the end game because you think you'd have an advantage at that point. All these things you're pushing in terms of mechanics, in terms of winning the game, it can actually then lead you on to a scene that you find really fun.
I suppose that's where there's this sort of slight GM proxy, where you've got in Hell for Leather, Joe, in the form of the cards. So whatever's on the card is the sort of slight inspiration. It doesn't have to be entire inspiration, but it gives you this tiny little starter for your next scene. And I think you were talking at one point about drawing up some tables about just like tiny little, again, inspirations. Like you'd roll, even if you had a D100 table with words, duck, or fireplace, or that kind of stuff. So you roll your D100 and you have this word, and in some way that word has to be involved in your scene. And it wouldn't direct it very much, but it's still, even that tiny little sort of kernel of creative ideas enough to get you started in some ways like that. I found that with the Hell for Leather, that even if I'm not feeling very creative or very energetic or whatever, I can make up stuff in that easier because I just take the idea from the card and that sort of generates something a lot easier.
That's true. I think for this year, cards are the new dice. Roleplay Legends, Robin Laws, and James Wallace have both got Kickstarters that are done for new games that are using cards, card-based mechanics.
Right.
Watch this space. But fingers crossed, I've been in touch with James Wallace because his new game. Oh, it will. Stop me if this sounds familiar. It's a tarot-based game of supernatural horror.
Protagonist. Yeah, I saw that Kickstarter.
By digging themselves out of a shallow grave in Las Vegas.
Okay.
So you sit here and talk. Is it your lawyers that are in
is that the one that's called Shell for Feathers or something?
No, it's called Alas Vegas. I'm going to be in touch with him and I'm going to maybe cross promote with Hell for Leather, hopefully, and see might have added as one of the rewards. Like if people pledge a certain amount, then they can get a copy of Hell for Leather as well.
Yes.
So they'll have something to get their teeth into the tarot decks before they get their Las Vegas.
Aye.
That's a great way to get
if you really want to confuse them, you could also get involved to see if you can get them copies of Hell for Leather.
Oh, yeah.
Aye, both versions.
Oh, yeah.
They're not versions. They're entirely different games.
Yeah.
So a little bit of explanation for the listeners there. Hell 4, the number 4 leather, is a different game. It's a dice-based agility combat game.
Oh, yeah, well, the other way around.
Mine's the number. Mine's 4.
Oh, Christ. Sorry. Yes, the tarot-based horror game, not the new tarot-based horror game. That's a Las Vegas. The Hell FOR leather is the agility-based
dice tower-based
game.
Which has got a cool mechanic, trying to knock over a tower of dice, but you've got to land it in certain places, don't you?
It's bad if you knock the tower over. You have to try and not knock the tower over, but get your D10 within the circle.
Is that what it is? Right, okay. And if you do knock the tower over, the less far the dice go.
I think it's to do with how much they roll, like what the values are when the tower falls.
Right.
You add up all the dice, and the higher it is, the worse. So yeah, if it's a really high tower you knock over, then yeah, you're probably dead.
Anyway, good stuff.
Are we
done?
Yeah, I think we probably are.
I was going to say about the Hill Folk game, where you're talking about little pointers coming out of the tarot deck. One of the stretch goals or one of the bonus things one of the additional pledge things was the deck of cards, which will have the Hill Folk art in it. But also they'll have little, I don't know, I think it was more than the single words, more single random words on it. Mm. But it did actually have pointers on every single card.
That'll be interesting.
Setups, which if I'd only bloody remember to not play XCOM that for a half an hour that night and actually pledge to it, I would have bought them.
I think that's a really good idea. 52 cards with just a few words on each one.
More ideas. Tarot deck 78 cards.
Oh, is it? Okay.
I think Roman D. Laws is, I think the Hill Folk was just 52.
Just the major arcana.
52 card deck.
Fair enough. And Robin Laws is doing, for Las Vegas, it's been unlocked with one of the stretch goals that he's doing an article on using the tarot cards for inspiration and scenario building in role-playing games. So that'll be interesting to check out when that comes out.
Yeah. No, imagine, Nobody's thought of that before.
No one's thought of that before. Apart from the amazing game Swan Song, which please.
And Dragon vs. Gun as well.
Dragon vs. Gun, that's unreleased. I never actually got around to releasing that because. Because there was some issues with the artwork where it might not actually be out of copyright. So anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And there's a few things I want to tweak. So. But I should get that out because I really like that game. It's a good game.
Yeah.
I've had some good stories out of that.
Cool. Well, yeah, let's tie up. That's about enough of the GM-less games. No, no, the role of the GM, sorry.
The role of the GM,
role of the GM. Cool. Well, thanks for listening, folks. I've been Colin Gray, Gamer Colin on Twitter, colin@dicingdesign.com.
And I'm Grant at Grant Sensei and Grant at dicingwithdesign.com.
Well done.
And I'm the Prince of Darkness, aka at Joe J Prince on Twitter. You can check out my website, Prince Darkness Games, or get me on the Dicing with Design email, like everyone else.
Yeah, don't say that again. And everyone, we'd really appreciate it if you've somehow, against all odds, got to this point in the podcast. We'd really appreciate it if you could put on a review in iTunes, or even just drop us a comment on the blog, or just get in touch in some way, and give us some ideas for future topics you'd like to hear about. We've got plenty of our own, but it'd be great to get some listener feedback just for what you'd actually like to hear about, from expert games designer Joe and his lackeys, me and Grant. And interviewers as well. If you've got ideas for anybody you'd like to get interviewed, that'd be good, because we are willing to go out there and get them. So thanks very much. Cheers for the chat, guys.
Cheers.
See you later.
And we'll talk to you next time.